This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Black women in America are three times more likely to die from a pregnancy-related cause than white women. Maternal mortality is just one health disparity that researchers and doctors are working to understand, and the pandemic has shone a spotlight on the most glaring health inequities over the last 2 years. For more on what those inequities are and what the solutions might be, I talked with three people who are paying close attention to the issues. Well, joining us, Dr. Kelly Tice. She's the Health Equity Officer for Florida Blue. Dr. Tice, thank you so much for being here.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
We're also joined by Dr. Saleh Rahman. He is Professor of Medicine and Co-Director of the Focused Inquiry and Research Experience Program at UCF's College of Medicine, where he teaches about culture, health, and society. Dr. Rahman, thank you as well.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we're also joined by journalist Retta Peoples. She recently produced a series of articles and mini-documentaries on healthcare disparities. Retta, thanks as well.
Thank you for having me.
Retta, I want to start with you. You've written about three of the factors in healthcare disparities: legislative, environmental, and generational. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why you decided to focus on these three aspects of health disparities.
Well, actually, initially, those three aspects were my targets. And then as I got deeper into it, I realized that there was a social justice element to this as well. So I also touched on in the many documentaries about health inequities, which is different from health disparities a little bit. It has that social determinant that's in there. So all four of those things, generational habits, environmental, legislative, and social, were just four of the things that I thought would really get people to understand the basics about health disparities.
One of the other things that really stands out too, and you write about this, is the disproportionately high maternal mortality rates amongst Black and brown women. What are some of the reasons that the experts are telling you about the disparity in maternal mortality, and are lawmakers paying attention to this?
Yeah, one of the experts told me that Black women, non-Hispanic Black women, are three times more likely to die from childbirth, in childbirth, than white women. You know, and then when you go to pregnancy issues and things like that during the pregnancy, out of 100,000 women, 11 will die from pregnancy-related issues and causes. When it gets to Black women, that's really non-Hispanic Black women. It's 44 out of 100,000 women who will die from pregnancy-related causes. You know, we just have to ask ourselves, what's causing that? How do we fix it?
Dr. Kelly Tice, I want to turn to you now. Your position, Health Equity Officer, is a new one at Florida Blue, but before that, you were a family physician, right? I'm wondering, kind of, in your career, what are some of the biggest gaps in healthcare access and equity that you've seen? And just thinking about this issue of maternal mortality and some of the statistics that Retta mentioned are quite staggering. What do you kind of think about as you contemplate this issue?
Well, first, let me clarify that I came to Florida Blue about 3 years ago as a senior medical director for medical affairs after having had a career in public health. Mm-hmm. And this position of chief health equity officer actually also includes a promotion to vice president of medical affairs. The reason that's important, not only is this the chief health equity officer position new and very important because of the position that GuideWell and Florida Blue has chosen to take in terms of working towards solutions for health disparities. But it's also important because as Vice President of Medical Affairs, the work that was already under my area of responsibility as it relates to looking at emerging infections, for instance, so public health surveillance, working closely with our quality teams and ensuring that we have equitable outcomes, responding to as clinical lead for COVID-19, as we watched COVID show us where health disparities existed, right? These aren't new conversations. So it is a logical expansion or extension of the role, but the dedicated focus with having a chief health equity officer really serves to allow us to expand some of the collaborative partnerships and relationships that are necessary to solve this. to your question about maternal morbidity, you know, just as with infant mortality, these are not numbers that are new to us, unfortunately. These are conversations that those of us who have worked in this area have had for decades. What has been missing is the ability, the desire, and the resources to host and have the right conversations and to reach upstream and address the things that become those determinants, right? So, and each of these issues, maternal morbidity, significantly so, has a lot of factors. It's related to the health of the mom at the time of pregnancy and delivery. It's related to stigma. You know, Black women require, in many cases, an advocate, a champion, in order to be heard in the health setting. They are less likely to be believed if they report pain or discomfort or distress. And all of those things have to be solved with a collaborative approach, because the things that drive it actually come from multiple different factors. And so the solutions have to be intensely and specifically collaborative.
Professor Rahman, what are some of the biggest health disparities that you've been tracking, and what are your thoughts on, you know, some of the causes? I'm wondering too, kind of from an academic point of view, has there been a change in the time that you've been working on some of these issues? Like, are you seeing people become more aware of these disparities and what needs to happen to change these things?
Thank you so much. I think the reflection coming from my panelists, co-panelists, what they said, I totally agree with all of it. And from academic viewpoint, we must understand the intersectionality if we want to understand the health inequity both. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that every person, whoever residing in this community, residing in this society, are affected by multiple factors, and being a minority could be even double dipping, triple dipping sometime. For example, I have studied cancer last 20 years, screening behavior, screening, even in Tallahassee. I was 12 years faculty at Florida A&M University with Tallahassee Memorial Hospital, and also affiliated with the FSU College of Medicine. Mm-hmm. We had multiple National Institute of Health funded projects. I directed, co-directed, for the underserved community in Gadsden County, in Leon County. And I can explain some of these are improving, but some are not. And that goes even deeper to our policy level issues, structural issues, systemic issues. Those are needs to be addressed. For example, I have been tracking something called community economic status. I coined that word by measuring, you know, average income or median income per zip code, availability of resources, transportation, distance to mammography facilities like that. And as you know, now we call the zip code is better predicted than genetic code for reason, because of that. We recently did a study with our Florida cancer data, and two of my students actually looked into top five cancers. And we compared first 15 years disparity versus last 15 years disparity. In fact, not very significant change happened. Change happening, but that change could be attributable to the other factors, not a drastic change in our policy.
I wanted to ask about education too, Professor Rahman, because part of your role is helping guide these medical students and this, you know, the next generation of doctors. So how important is education of the next generation of healthcare professionals and bridging some of these gaps in healthcare? And I wonder too about a broader pool of new graduate doctors and medical professionals. Is that going to help right some of these wrongs that have been around for a long time?
Absolutely. I saw that as an academician, and that was my focus of even teaching, even research area. I believe our future physicians can not only make a difference in their own practices, but become an advocate for change. And I thought in society, even in to policymakers, the physicians are highly regarded about their opinion, about their expert views. So those needs to be bring into an advocacy. and active change, the action type of change. For example, in the curriculum, Institute of Medicine, American Medical Association, everybody recognized that our curriculum are not sufficiently training our future physicians, understanding the concept of intersectionality, disparity, equity, how different type of factors are affecting. Like someone with low education, low income, living in a poor condition, socioeconomic condition, all those will be leading to a social stressor. And that has huge impact even biologically. We can prove that the person's health status will not be okay. Even the COVID, I think, exposed a tremendous amount of that disparity. Like, you know, when an African-American, say, for example, getting the disease or cases, if we consider with the non-Hispanic white population, the death is coming 1.7 times and hospitalization coming 2.5 times. So that signifies that so many factors are playing role, starting from even in our curriculum, we need to understand when we interview or take a history of a patient, what are the social factors we actually gather? We only ask about, okay, do you smoke? Do you drink? This type of, so we did never ask, or I'm not saying never. I mean, some people are doing definitely. We do not explore their social support, social network, their social stressor coming from different factors. So those are the factors and how interprofessional combination like social work, nursing, physical therapy, pharmacy student, all together can create a comprehensive plan for the betterment of the patient. So those are the education much needed. And that's what we are thriving for at UCF.com. And I think many medical schools are heading to that direction.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about health disparities. We're with Dr. Kelly Tice, Professor Saleh Rahman, and journalist Retta Peoples. And speaking of COVID-19, that does bring up a point that all of you have mentioned, touched on, and talked about. Retta, I want to come back to you because in some of your reporting on health disparities, you highlighted how the focus at the start of the pandemic was on the elderly as a population of significant risk of COVID, but there wasn't so much a focus on Black and brown people, even though those households were affected worse than white households. Just talk a little bit about, you know, what you uncovered there and whether you have a sense that maybe that disparity has changed at all in the last 2 years, or are we still facing the same kind of disparity in that regard?
Some of these health disparities that we're talking about now, a lot of us know and have known for a long time that there are a lot of disparities and inequities in the Black community. Dr. Fauci got on stage and actually talked about the health disparities when it comes to specifically Black people. And I remember watching that or hearing that and going into the living room and watching the TV saying, I can't believe that somebody actually just spoke out about health disparities in a discussion that really wasn't about health disparities. It was about COVID. So I thought that was really, really good. Legislatively, there have been numerous things that a lot of legislators have tried to do in the past. I think back in the 80s, the National Cancer Institute pulled together a task force, and that task force was on Black and minority health. That actually led to legislation like the Minority Health Improvement Act. So that kind of took us down a road that was supposed to close the gap. However, I don't know if we're really where we need to be. Well, I know we're not where we need to be as far as closing the gap. It's interesting. It'll be interesting to find out what some of those ideas, as we move forward in this, what some of those ideas will be to help close that gap.
And I do wonder, too, if some of them could be applied to things other than COVID-related or pandemic-related, right? If we're talking about kind of bigger systemic changes to help sort of bridge some of these inequities.
Absolutely. And, you know, even with COVID, in some areas, it was hard to get to a place that had the vaccine. When the vaccine first came to Florida, they were, I believe they were in the grocery stores like Publix. And a lot of those grocery stores aren't in Black communities. So that made it very difficult for us to get to places to be vaccinated. And then if you want to go back historically, you know, there's things like the Tuskegee experiment, the Tuskegee research study, where it was people were being injected with syphilis, Black men, and they weren't given the actual, even though there was a cure for that, they weren't given the treatment, which was basic penicillin. You know, so rightfully so, a lot of Black people have fears of the United States medical industry, you know, and it dates back, you know, historically decades. Mm-hmm. So I think now, even with COVID bringing that into the mix, a lot of us are still leery of the vaccine.
Dr. Tice, you alluded to this before. You were at the forefront of Florida Blue's COVID response. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the challenge in health equity, health disparity, that the last 2 years of the pandemic has brought to light.
Sure. You know, those of us, again, who have worked in this space, when the initial data began to emerge related to COVID-19 and its impacts, we rapidly understood, you know, a condition that was worse in folks with diabetes, lung disease, obesity, and, you know, social condition challenges was invariably going to be worse in marginalized populations where we knew control of those diseases was already, you know, not what it should be. What our response, though, demonstrated was the need, the value of applying the data that you have and then collaborating to solve. So one of the things that Retta mentioned, you know, the initial allocation of vaccines were deployed through major grocery store chain, for instance, through their retail pharmacies first. But it really left even those who were in minority communities that would have accepted vaccine, it left them without access. And the way to solve that and what we chose to do was to take a look at our communities around the state, look at vaccine rates, and look at the areas of highest social vulnerability. One of the reasons that the structural and institutional discriminatory and racist issues, they actually present as health outcomes problems is because they create things like household overcrowding, poor access to jobs where folks can earn a living wage. Mm-hmm. And it was all of those things that kept folks from being able to take safety precautions when the pandemic began, right? Mm-hmm. Couldn't stay home from work. Maybe you didn't have proper personal protective equipment, so you couldn't protect yourself. If you didn't work, you didn't get paid, kind of thing.
Even taking time to go get a vaccine, I mean, that may be a high bar for a lot of folks who are working 2-3 jobs potentially, or maybe transportation access to vaccine sites might be an issue as well.
Exactly. So the approach to solving that has to be created with that in mind. When the event is scheduled, where the event is hosted, what sort of policy do you have related to no-shows or missed or late appointments? All of those things have to reflect the population that you're trying to manage. And our approach really was one to solve for the member, the patient, the resident of the community with the most challenges first. Because if we could solve it for someone who was transportation challenged, who, for instance, had to be able to access vaccine after a work shift, if we solved it for them, then those who were able to drive across 2 or 3 sets of county lines to get vaccine, we knew they were going to be okay. And once we identified the areas of highest needs in our communities around the state, we then identified the partner that was necessary to solve for that, right? We don't house vaccine, we don't give it outside of our clinical assets, but we could partner then with the retail, the neighborhood pharmacists in those areas we had identified to actually host and sponsor some of those vaccine clinics. And the gift of that is once Florida Blue has sort of left that community after that event, the relationship with the neighborhood pharmacist was strengthened and it remained. And that's where the value and that sort of collaboration is. One of the things I think, you know, is a long-term investment we've got to make, and my colleague alluded to it, is we've got to improve representation in the medical fields. One of the challenges for us as we tried to solve for some of that vaccine hesitancy in the communities that were at greatest risk of severe disease from COVID-19 was to identify physicians and other clinical leaders in those communities that could carry the message And so the underrepresentation that Blacks and other minorities experience in the medical fields really shows up in circumstances like this, because the folks that we're trying to reach really want to hear from an expert that they trust, that they feel has at least similar lived experience. One of our long range efforts is through our Equity Alliance to actually invest in more training and support of underrepresented minorities in fields like medicine and, you know, other graduate level type careers.
Well, Professor Rahman, back to you for a moment. I mean, thinking about the vaccine as one aspect of the pandemic and its rollout, what are you seeing in terms of maybe a change in how it was deployed at the start versus what we're seeing now? Like, have some of the disparities that we might have seen at the start of the rollout been resolved, or do you still see some of these kind of lingering problems with vaccine access and distribution now?
So this is a great point and great question. I think we all should pay attention to the basic stuff that I always talk about when it comes to COVID. If we look at six factors, like risk to exposure, risk to severe illness, disparities in COVID-related hospitalization, disparities in COVID-related underlying comorbidities, disparities in death, or even some unintended consequences. All these even six, seven factors I can name. And each and every component has deep link to the social determinants of health. Social determinants, when you call, okay, some person low income, low education, living in a low socioeconomic or poor condition, crowded area, you have higher exposure to COVID. Simple. And same way, when it comes to the severity of the illness, we are looking into undercurrent causes, and tons of evidence are coming out that if someone has comorbidity situation, diabetes, hypertension, other kidney diseases, all those are also playing some role in terms of severity of the disease. Hospitalization also linked to those factors. Mm-hmm. Who had exposure to those comorbidities more? Historically, we see because of the lack of access and all other factors that we mentioned are connected, interconnected. That's why I mentioned so many times that intersectionality is important. Mm-hmm. When it comes to the prevention, I will go back and I give this example even in my class, that how public trust could be ruined in long time ago, like Tuskegee, and still can affect. In fact, when I was students in one of my degrees in Alabama, and I went to Tuskegee area, actually interviewed local people to see their perception about science and receptiveness of science. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Still mistrust, still, I would say, disconnection, that the breach of public trust. How much we have done to overcome those, how much social marketing we did with COVID-related vaccination, almost, I would say, like negligible to me. So advocacy, social marketing, education needed, at the same time, the structural, the distribution issue, the where we can reach, the access also very, very important, because if someone has a full-time job, sometimes two jobs, where they can get very easily, where they can get those without much effort. Rather, you know, I can go anytime. I'm driving and waiting in the line because I don't have to worry about something else, daycare or my childcare or even my another shift of job. Those are connected. And I do not think we have done enough.
Dr. Tice, I wonder what you think about what you're going to be looking at as some of the biggest challenges on the other side of the pandemic. What do you think some of the biggest challenges to health equity are going to be?
Sure. So, you know, first of all, I echo everything that was just stated. We have got to be able to solve some of those things that impact delayed care and contribute to the fact that minority women, minorities in general, tend to show up later in the disease process before they're originally initially diagnosed. To that end, one of the COVID impacts that we've seen is delayed care. You know, folks were fearful about coming into health settings.
Right.
You know, maybe they, because of their finances, they didn't feel like they could afford it. You know, so, but that will translate into newly diagnosed cancers and other things that could have been prevented with typical care. We now have record numbers of people who have signed up in marketplace plans through this open enrollment period. And so there's this opportunity now for us to be very intentional, very early about identifying those folks and routing them appropriately to preventive services and screening. That means we have to address those things that were just described, right? If mm-hmm. you know, what is their understanding of health and healthcare and how to access the health system? So, you know, we do something called, you know, unboxing your plan, where we teach people, you know, what it is you bought, so that they know how to leverage that. You know, as a physician educator, when I was in practice, I would, you know, often say to my patients, you know, listen, this is what you should expect when you go here. You know, this is what you should get. This is the product you're buying. You're taking your healthcare dollar and you are spending it somewhere. And this is what you should get in return. Many people, depending upon, you know, generations of limited access, really don't even know how to engage services in the health system. And that's why we see folks seek primary care, for instance, in emergency room settings, right? Mm-hmm. So we want folks getting the right care, you know, from the right provider or clinician at the right time. And that takes intervention on multiple levels. But I think if there were, you know, if there's one thing that we were going to double down on this year, it is really ensuring that our members have meaningful access. So not just you're assigned a doc, there's a, you know, a physician's name on the back of your card, but that we have removed the barriers that exist to getting you connected. Mm-hmm. And by doing so, because our members live in communities, right, with other Florida residents, we hope to model the right sort of behaviors and influence the entire community in terms of their health behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Rita Peoples, I want to give you the last word here. I wonder what you think about the role of the media in addressing some of these health disparities and helping bridge the gaps that exist in healthcare. What role do you think the media is going to play going forward?
Well, we have a lot to do. We have a lot to do in the media to make people aware of what's happening, these disparities, these inequities. But more importantly, I think legislation is the key. As mm-hmm. far as trying to change hearts and minds of people who may or may not believe that disparities even exist, I think we've been trying to do that for far too long. I think what we need now is legislators who are going to go to bat for us, who are going to talk about these disparities. We got Senator Becca Rausch in Massachusetts, who is fighting for health justice, environmental justice. We need more people like that in Congress. And I think that's the way we close this gap.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with journalist Retta Peoples. She's produced a series of articles and mini documentaries about health disparities. Retta, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Matthew.
Also joining us today, Dr. Kelly Tice. She is the Chief Health Equity Officer and Vice President of Medical Affairs for Florida Blue and Guidewell. Dr. Tice, thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sailat Rahman, Professor of Medicine at UCF's College of Medicine. Dr. Rahman, thank you so much as well.
Thank you, and glad to be here.